what the components of an actual human civilization are. And then you can judge for yourself whether we indeed have a human civilization now. Certainly, you can recognize a human being in terms of two arms, two legs, and all that. But is there something more to being human than just having a human body? Is there some kind of behavior, or is there some kind of goal in life that makes a human being special? According to the Vedic knowledge of ancient India, just because you have two legs, two arms, and a head doesn't exactly make you a human being. In other words, according to the Vedic standpoint, just to physiologically be a human being is not enough. You have to have the proper human activities and goal in life. Otherwise, there's a word in Sanskrit. Sanskrit's a very ancient language, still used in India today. There's a word, dvipashu. And dvipashu means an animal but with two legs. Now this sounds quite horrifying. Might I be such an entity? Many people today don't mind actually being referred to as, you know, animals. You all know the phrase party animal. Many times that's considered an honor, right? Someone calls you a party animal? Yeah, that's right. And I've talked to many people who, they feel proud that there's not much difference between human beings and animals, and, you know, animals have a lot of fun. Sometimes they say with great gusto that such and such a thing brings out the animal in me. You've probably heard things like that before. So they think, you know, this is nice, natural, you know, natural and spontaneous. Rather than thinking so much, just let the animal in you come out, and then there's fun. Now, we discussed how there's a physiological definition of the human being, but we should also discuss another way of looking at humanness, activities and goals in life. According to the Vedic standard of ancient India, a human being has as his or her goal, at least, or at the very minimum, the goal to understand how we are not the body, we are something different than this body. From the Vedic standpoint, that is the minimal definition of a human being. Someone who can at least understand the body is matter, but myself is something non-material. Now, how does society today stack up to this standard? No one has any clear-cut knowledge of what the self is. If you go to Victoria University, many professors will try to teach you that the self is just matter. Even your conception that you have a self, that's just something conjured up by the brain, the matter in the brain. There's no proof that your selfhood is matter. But if you want to reject any non-material understanding of the self, you've got to create myths, the matter myth. The self is matter. There's nothing more to it than that. So you should dedicate your life to making pleasing arrangements of matter so you'll be happy. Matter comes in different combinations as you, as your family, your society, your friends. So you just keep shuffling and arranging the matter so that sometimes the combinations and permutations will please you. That's supposed to be the goal of life. Of course, this is not accepted according to the Vedic standard. According to the Vedic standard, human life begins when you can understand, I am not the body, I am spirit soul. Those of you who are regular guests here, you know how in the text, Bhagavad Gita, the basic spiritual text of India, there it is stated that you have a gross body of physical matter, and you have a subtle body of astral type matter, known as mind, intelligence, and false ego. You are neither of these bodies. You are neither of these coverings. You are an anti-material particle. You are the spirit soul, which is covered by the gross body and the subtle body. So, to be a human being, you at least have to understand this point. And once you understand this point, that has a complete effect on your life. Because you're thinking, if indeed I am not matter, then why should I strive for material pleasure? What's the point? I'm not matter. Let me strive for spiritual pleasure, because I'm the spirit soul, non-material identity. I'm sure you can easily understand that this question about your identity is most important. Because according to what you think you are, you'll endeavor in that way. Now just think about your responsibilities. Just think about the things you have accepted as the chores and duties, obligations you have to do in your life. How many of those obligations, responsibilities, and duties are in relation to bodily things? I have to do this to take care of my body. I have to have a roof over my body. I have to have clothes on my body, particularly good fashions. And I have to have food in the belly, and then the lusts of the body have to be satisfied. So, if not daily, at least on weekends, there has to be a compatible warm body somewhere near me. And yes, these are the needs of the body. And then, not only is there your body, but there are bodies in relation to your body. And this is mother, this is father, sister, brother, child, son, daughter, like that. You take particular interest in bodies that are related to your body. Actually, all living entities are part of one family. So it's kind of interesting how certain bodies you feel concerned about and others you don't. You feel concerned about bodies connected to you in the same nuclear family. You feel a special concern for bodies of the same nation. The Kiwi bodies. Yes, you'll take an interest in Kiwi bodies. Anything that's in proximity by relation to your body, there's a special pull for that. And you like to see other people according to their bodily classification. You see, in this way, all of society is caught up in this body game. I have this kind of body, which I am, of course, I am this kind of body, and you are that kind of body. Now, is there something we can do? You're always sizing up different bodies. You ever catch yourself doing that? Oh, look at this body. What can this body do for me? And what about that body? And what about the bodies that are in relation to my body? The family bodies or the nationality bodies. You're always looking at people in that way. How many of you have tried looking at people as if they're not the body? As if they're not the mind. If indeed you have spiritual vision, you'll see all living entities as equal. Lord Krishna explains this in Bhagavad Gita. The vision of equality, seeing all living entities as equal, whether you're looking at a dog or an elephant or a very intelligent human being, someone who's actually wise sees all these creatures, all these entities as equal, because the spirit soul within them is equal, even though the body is different. For example, you and I are wearing different clothes, but still we say that we're all human beings. Now, you can take that in the spiritual sense to say that regardless of all the different types of bodily clothes, different types of bodies, we are all spirit soul, parts of Krishna. So in that way everyone is equal. Even though someone may have the body of a dog and someone may have the body of an elephant or intellectual human being, still there's equality on the spiritual platform because of the equality of the soul. But there can never be equality on the material platform because every body is different. There are bodies in this room that can do things you can't do. Now how can you say they're equal? Do you have any mothers here? Of children. Mothers. No, you're not a mother. But that's my point. You can't do that. I asked him, are there any mothers here? He raised his hand. Sorry. You can't do that. There's a mother back there. Yes. Now, this is something you have over the men. Try as they might. They won't be able to do what you did in having a child. And similarly, try as you might, you can't father a child. Bodies are different. They're not equal in every respect. If you're going to establish true equality, it has to be done on the spiritual platform, because the spirit soul in everyone's body is equal, but the bodies themselves are not equal. Some bodies in this room are stronger than other bodies. Some are smarter in terms of material intelligence, the way intelligence is ordinarily conceived. Some are more beautiful, some are younger, some are older. So you can't make bodies equal. Still, people try to establish peace and unity in this world based on the body, and it doesn't work. Recently, I was talking to the parents of one New Zealand devotee who's living in Melbourne now. The parents live in Rotorua. So I had to go see them for something, and so well, ordinarily for our daughter to be in Australia, a country like that, would be a source of anxiety for us. Living in Australia, those Aussies. But anyway, Melbourne, that's a lot like New Zealand, so it'll be all right. This is how people see things in terms of the body. Our type of bodies and those type of bodies. When I was coming from India to Perth a couple of weeks ago, from Mumbai to Perth, and one of those flights that got in at, what time did I land in Perth? 4 o'clock in the morning. So, that's the only flight coming in. So, the immigration officers and the customs people, they hate those flights because they have to stay awake, just for that flight. So they're really cranky and nasty, and they just give you a hard time. So they, they can sniff out who's actually an Australian and who looks like they're a bit exotic. every time I go to Perth, I know, okay, they're gonna make me open up all my suitcases and check everything, because, here's an exotic-looking guy, Actually, the New Zealanders don't do it. They have a different mentality, like, we would never do anything to make you want to feel you're different. No, please, go right along. This is New Zealand. We don't discriminate against any different kinds of bodies. The Aussies, we're not like that, Hey, mate, look a bit different, don't you? Come on over here. I was walking along, and I went up to the passport control, and I know their system now. Good morning, how are you? And they look at you and they kind of write something on your card, you know, a little code. That means when you go to the guy at the customs, hey, pull you over. So, for this flight, they had like customs people everywhere, even before you got to the nothing to declare or the red door, something to declare, the red sign. The customs agents would approach you even before you got to their station, So, one lady came up to me. Where are you from? I was gonna make her day, or I was gonna make her morning. She latched onto an exotic looking creature, and probably from Burma or Cameroon or something, a refugee trying to break into Australia. So I handed her my passport. It was the last thing I expected. You're a Kiwi. She said, like, you're a Kiwi, aren't you, huh? And I didn't say anything. She's not going to answer my question. I just smiled and said, all right, you're not going to say anything.
You're a Kiwi, huh?
All right, just go. As I was going up, then I went to the actual customs place, and they were all ready. Oh, look at this one. The same old thing again. I could see them myself. Oh, where's he from? Bangladesh? Sierra Leone? Was he dressed as a Hare Krishna? He's probably got a suitcase full of marijuana. We can confiscate it and use it all ourselves. As if no one smokes marijuana in Perth. And they're just like, well, look at this one. Good day, mate. Get your passport.
That was the last thing I expected to see. That's what he said. This is the last thing I expected to see.
All right, mate. You don't have to open your suitcase. Just, Kiwis. We thought we had a big cash. He's just a Kiwi. We thought, he's going to be like, Congo smuggling diamonds or something. Or Burma smuggling heroin. But he's just a Kiwi. So this shows you how people are so focused on body types. And that's a particular obvious example. I think you've got the customs guys. But let's think how we all do this throughout our day. Just catch yourself tomorrow. Not today, but tomorrow. Catch yourself sizing up people's bodies. Isn't it embarrassing? Oh, look at that body. Yeah, that one's got promise. I'll check that one out. In this way, you can see how you're addicted to considering the material body as being so important. How often do you, when you're walking on the street, you check out somebody walking by, look at that spirit soul. How often do you do that? No, look at that body. So we can see in this way how our vision is material. We don't have any idea how to relate to people as spirit soul. That is very embarrassing, because even though we may espouse a certain religion, or we may call ourselves spiritual persons, how does that translate into action? We don't know how to see spiritually or relate to people spiritually. Therefore, our religions and our spiritual outlook just becomes a facade. For your spiritual outlook to actually have some substance to it, you have to understand that people are not the body. They're wearing the body just like you wear clothes. They are a spiritual entity, an anti-material particle, or non-material particle. This is the first lesson given in Bhagavad Gita. Now catch yourself throughout the day, not only looking at people like they're the body, but also desiring their bodies. Yeah. This material body has, your material body, has kind of a purr to it, just like you hear cats purr. Well, even in the human species, the male body, the female body, they kind of purr, you know, when they're near each other. So you catch yourself doing that. We're not the body. The body is matter, yet the way nature has it arranged, when, you know, bodies are near each other, they just, you know, start to talk to each other, the bodies, you know, in certain language. But we're not the body. So you have to ask yourself this question next time your body starts to purr. If I'm not the body and the other person's not the body, why are there these feelings? This is a kind of inquiry that will lead you to advancement. Why am I experiencing this? Why am I feeling this if we're not the body, if we're actually spirit soul? Then you should begin to think, how do I relate to somebody as a spirit soul? You see, it's a great honor and a rare privilege for someone to treat you as if you are the spirit soul and not the body. It's very refreshing. It's very liberating. When you come here, we hope we're treating you like that. You may feel refreshed and relieved from the fatigue of body identification. Body identification is very fatiguing and tiring. It's the same old thing you've been feeling for many, many lifetimes. Not only as a human being, but as other creatures. You've been treated as if you're the body. So, through this lifetime anyway, at least this lifetime you can remember. So in this lifetime, you're already tired of being treated as if you're the body. There's no more suspense left about the bodies. As soon as you're 12 or 13, you start cohabiting in some way or another with the opposite sex. There's nothing, no mystery. You know, no one said, how many parents say to their kids, wait until you get married? The parents don't say that because they didn't. And most of the time anyway, the parents aren't married themselves. So what can they say to their kids? I noticed by the time teenagers are 18 and 19, they've already got this fatigued, burnt out look to them. Like, we've just exploited our bodies to the maximum. There's nothing more to look forward to. We've done it all already. All the mysteries of life have been plundered. By the time we were 16, we went through it all. What else is there to do? So they have this fatigued, dried out look in their face. Like, kind of like, you know, dried prunes or raisins, you know. When they're just 18 or 19. Just think about it. What is there to look forward to? I remember when I was a little boy in the 50s, all the pop songs were always about, gee, I want to get married, don't you? The grown-ups don't understand that we're really in love and we want to marry even though we're 16. You never hear any songs like that though these days, of course not. As soon as you're 12 or 13, you're plundering all the mysteries of the body. So much so that, as I said, by the time you're 18 or 19, you've been there, done that, seen this, said that. What is there to life? Then you think, maybe if I go on my OE, if I go overseas, I'll do the same thing in a different place and it'll be more exotic. Right? So you do your 2-year stint in London. It's real different there, you know. Some of you are laughing knowingly. You do your 2-year stint in London. Is it still 2 years or are they reducing it now? So, And then you come back. You never tell anybody that it was the same old thing, you had a miserable time. What happens when you get back from your OE? Wow, it was great. You should have been there. You never tell anyone of all the hurts and frustrations you have. So in this way, the ruse is perpetuated. And then you settle in to life in New Zealand again, knowing there's not much to look forward to, except getting drunk on the weekends or just smoking marijuana or something. Reminds me once when I was traveling on the South Island, and I was in Blenheim. I just happened to be talking to some young people. You know, they could see I was a Hare Krishna monk. So they were talking to me, and so I think, well, what do you do, you guys? You're 17, 18, 19. What do you do in a town like Blenheim? You know, what's the thrill? I said, oh, we just get wasted. And they said, but we get wasted in some really beautiful places. Special. It's different getting wasted in Blenheim. In other words, nothing to do in the town. All we do is get wasted, but we know some beautiful places to get wasted in. And what was the other thing they told me they did? I think it's called tagging. Is that the right word? Yeah, you put little bombs in people's post boxes. Now, tagging is graffiti. You spray paint. Yeah, they did tagging, spray painting, and they also do something else where you put little bombs in people's post boxes, you know, and explode them. That was all they had to do in the town. I can look at these young people, not only in Blenheim, I see it in Wellington all the time. By the time they're 18, 19, and 20, they've got that dried up look to them. No mysteries to the body anymore. It's like, you know, you ever taken a dry towel and tried to wring it? Tried to wring a dry towel. That's what they tried to do. Squeezing pleasure out of the body, but they're not the body, so you just become very exhausted and frazzled. And I can see that happens by the time you're 18 or 19. There's no mystery left to the women, no mystery left to the men. So you start getting a bit rough and callous, you know. You gotta do something to be happy. Come here. things start to get that rough and that callous, you know. Just, who cares about anyone anyway? Just do what you gotta do to get what you need. Life starts to come down to that. All this unnecessary stress and strain is due to identifying with something that you're not. The first real relief that you'll feel is not to think you're the body. Then you're spared from all the frustrating endeavors to satisfy your body. The next thing you have to find out, though, is what is your positive identity? It is true. Simply to understand you're not the body, the negative side, that will qualify you as a human being. Not just because you have two legs, two arms, but because you attain the minimal level of spiritual understanding required of a human being. I am not this body of matter. I'm not the mind of subtle matter. I'm something else. Now, what are you? That's the next level in enlightenment. You are a spirit soul, non-material entity. If that is so, then I should find out all about the spirit soul, the activities of the spirit soul, the activities of the spirit soul and perfection. This is the most fascinating subject matter. How to use this temporary body that you're not for spiritual attainment. That is the greatest art. How to use the temporary to achieve the eternal. How to use the body, which you are not, to attain the spirit soul, which you are. These are some of the things that Krishna consciousness is concerned with. We don't turn our backs on the temporary world of matter. We say, use that temporary world of matter as an instrument for aiding you in your efforts to understand the eternal. That is more intelligent than just blotting everything out and turning your back on it. Why not learn how to use it properly? A typical example that we give is, you're walking down, let's say, Lambton Key, and you see, you know, a $10 bill on the ground. How many of you would walk by? You saw a $10 bill on the ground. Anyone here walk by? Just, hey, it's not mine, I don't know whose it is. You know, I'm just keeping walking. None of you would walk by. How many of you would say, hey, there's a $10 note, I'll pick it up and put it in my pocket? How many would do that? The world. And then somebody who picks up the bill and puts it in his or her pocket, that's like the typical materialist enjoyer. Everything is meant for my pleasure. $10 bill, my day is made. That bill's laying there just for me. Now, the person who picks it up and says, where is the actual owner? That is the bhakti yogi, the transcendentalist in Krishna consciousness. How to recognize that this world is composed of energy and use it for the pleasure of the proprietor of that energy. That's the most productive thing for you to do. Recognize that even the material energies of this world belong to someone. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that he is the origin of all matter and all spirit. Everything is owned by someone, therefore we have to take our knowledge from Krishna how to use everything. How to use everything properly is better than just turning your back on it. It's all material, it's all matter. And certainly, learning how to use everything properly is better than misappropriating things. How many of you, when you're driving along a highway, let's say you're on State Highway 1 and there's a construction area, you know, and overnight they leave the, what do you call them, the tractors and bulldozers and what do you call those things with the big rollers? Steamrollers. They still call them steamrollers even though they don't use. Anyway, the steamrollers, bulldozers, they leave them on the side of the road at night. Suppose you say, well, look at these things, just waiting on the road for me. I think I'll jump on one and start it up. You'd never do that. Every one of you knows that the steamroller, bulldozer, tractor, they belong to someone. They belong to a construction company. But when we are going through the world, living our life, we appropriate or misappropriate, shall we say, the world in that way. Look at this body. Ah, she's meant for me. He's meant for me. Look at these objects in this world. It's meant for my pleasure. No one thinks, or practically no one thinks, all the things of this world are meant to be used for a pure spiritual purpose. So what is that pure spiritual purpose? In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that when you use the temporary material energy of Krishna for the service of Krishna, then even the temporary material world can reveal its relation to the supreme spiritual source of everything. Krishna consciousness is about changing our vision so that we can see what to do even with the temporary matter. And you also learn how to treat people with equal vision as spirit soul. You give everyone a chance to be Krishna conscious, even though their bodies may be different. Whether you're a woman, man, born in this nation, born in somewhere else, whatever. Everyone has an equal chance to be Krishna conscious, regardless of the inequalities of their material body. Obviously, if we're going to make some spiritual progress, we have to do a complete overhaul on how we think of ourselves and how we think of the world around us. Without such an overhaul, we're just kidding ourselves that we're religious or spiritual. You notice, all the people, generally, who say we're religious, we're spiritual, what they do has not affected the world very much. Why is that? They can label themselves any kind of religion, or say they're taking up any kind of spiritual therapy or spiritual healing process or whatever. They can say that, but you don't see any change. Any significant change in the world around them. That is because, in spite of identifying with this religion or this spiritual therapy or process, they still think they're the body. They haven't gotten to the first stage of human life, which is to understand you're not the body. So as long as you think you're the body, then everything after that initial miscalculation is wrong. No matter what kind of religion you stamp yourself with. Like everybody recognizes as just futile and a waste of, enormous waste of energy, the situation in the Middle East, Israel and the PLO, Palestinians. Like, why don't you guys just stop fighting? What's the point? And both sides claim to be religious. Well, people see a situation like that and say, who wants anything to do with religion if this is what it's about? In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna will tell you that real religion begins with understanding you're not the body. In other words, there's no point in saying you are Israeli or you are Palestinian, you are Kiwi, you are Aussie, you are Yank. There's no point in saying that if you're actually practicing real religion. So the standard of spirituality in Bhagavad Gita is far beyond what people normally consider. They think religion means to believe. Well, I believe in, you know, and therefore I'm a... and you believe in, so therefore you're a... you can fill in the blanks, you know? We're not talking about beliefs and stamping yourself with different religious labels. We're talking about the basic realities. Do you identify with your body or not? Do you have any idea what to do as a spirit soul? Do you know how to treat people as if they're the spirit soul? These things form the basis of real spirituality. And here at this place, we'd like to introduce you to that real basis of genuine spirituality. So please make yourself a frequent visitor and please partake of the atmosphere. We tried to create here an atmosphere of no body exploitation. We want you to feel liberated from all bodily identification as soon as you walk in the door. And from that level, you can begin to make further spiritual progress, understanding your identity as spirit soul, part of Krishna. And soon you'll be inquiring, who is Krishna? What is my relationship with Krishna? Why have I forgotten Krishna? Why do I mistakenly think I'm the body? What's going on? All right, any questions? Why would you say it's a flick of white light? Why would you say it's a flick of white light? The Vedic knowledge will tell you that the spirit soul has form, and it's much more attractive than the material form. It's the eternal form. The Vedic knowledge explains that this material body has form based on the spirit soul. Just like when you wear a coat, the coat has a certain form because your body has a certain form. Similarly, this body that you have has that form because it's based on the form of the spirit soul. Now you might get smart and say, what about species of life that don't have two arms and two legs? Does that mean they don't have a spirit soul? Or, no. Just like you have two arms and two legs, but you can take a blanket and cover yourself until your limbs can't be seen. So bodies that don't have two arms and two legs, visible, they're like, it's like covered. Their material body covers the possibility of arms and legs. My point is that the spirit soul has form. And certainly the supreme spirit soul has form. We're generally accustomed to thinking of form as material, but Krishna consciousness will introduce you to the world of non-material form. That's quite fascinating. Yes? What are you doing in there?
Doing wrong things.
Oh, you got caught.
Yes.
Those others didn't get caught.
Yes. And there's no form there, so I have to, I mean, most of the time I come up doing things like this stuff and all that, the boat is caught up, I managed to, because there's no external distraction, I managed to experience some spirituality actually in the downside.
You can chant the Hare Krishna mantra in a jail cell, but we don't recommend that you go to jail to do that. Right. But sometimes we need a bit of distress to give us a kick in the rear, you know? When everything is going fine for your body, you don't have much incentive to think you're not the body. But as soon as you get very sick or some disaster happens, then, oh, there must be something else to life. Yes? The problem is that everyone in this world has no idea what they're doing. Whether you're a law enforcement official or whatever, no one knows what they're doing. Everyone identifies with the body and then pretends they know what they're doing. And they cause great havoc in the world. That havoc is not simply by war. The havoc also comes through interpersonal relationships. When someone treats you like you're the body, they're causing havoc in your life. You ever think of it that way? We're so foolish, we think it's an honor to be treated like we're the body. Isn't that true? Dishonor for someone to treat you like you're the body, because you're not the body. It is a great honor for someone to treat you like you are spirit soul. And that's what we try to do here. To treat someone like their spirit soul means to administer to their spiritual quest how to understand the supreme soul. If you want to administer to the body, then you can go to Les Mills gym or something like that. Full of people administering to the needs of their body. But where do you go to administer to the needs of the soul? You go to a church or whatever. They don't know they're not the body. Therefore their religious practice can never really take off because it's couched in the bodily concept of life. This is what keeps the ball on the ground. They can't get any higher. When you come here, we hope that you'll feel the gate to spiritual expansion. We hope you feel that gate swinging wide open. So that you can understand yourself as spirit soul, and you can understand Krishna, the supreme soul, and the infinitely pleasurable relationship between the two. Any else? Mm-hmm. Well, with your material eyes, you can't see the spirit soul, so it's not that you kind of... What you do is you treat them in such a way that will aid their spiritual development. Hopefully when you come here, you notice how everyone is treating you in such a way that your spiritual development is maximized. That's the main way to do it. Someone will size you up. Oh, you look like you could be such a lovely devotee of Krishna, having such a nice relationship with Krishna. How can we help you do that? How can you become full of spiritual knowledge, spiritual bliss? What can we do to assist you in that goal? No, let's give someone else a chance. All right? I hope I've stimulated your minds a bit to move more in this direction. Now we're going to chant Hare Krishna, which is the exaltation of the soul. The soul loves to chant the glories of the Supreme Soul. Just like there's spiritual form, non-material form, there's also spiritual sound, non-material sound. And the prime spiritual sound for reviving your awareness of your spiritual identity, the prime spiritual sound that does that is the Hare Krishna mantra. So we're all just going to chant a bit together. And if you're new, anyone here, never been here before? Raise your hand, please. Is that right? You have one. Anyone from the back there? Okay. Nothing to be nervous about. It's a pretty relaxed place, isn't it? Huh? Nothing strange going on. And you can really relax here because no one's going to treat you like you're the body. At least none of the staff members. We can't vouch for all the guests. Here your spiritual potential is catered to. We're just going to stand up and enthusiastically chant the Hare Krishna mantra. Have a good time chanting from the heart, singing loudly. You'll see the effects.